Good morning, everybody. Thank you for tuning in. This is Dr. Andrew Dyer with you this morning, live here in studio right before snowpocalypse hits. And yes, that's what they've been talking about all morning, and I'm not going to give you any further details right now, but when those beepers go off, we'll take a break and they'll inform you again. So in the hour that we have to share together this morning, I have several different topics that I want to enlighten you on. And one was a great article I found this week from Harvard about how technology, our phones, our computers, our tablets, is really affecting our health, our longevity, our sleep quality. So we're going to run through a couple of those quick bullet points from that article. And then I want to share with you two different cancer cases from this week. They're both at the beginning, and so I don't have any pre and post results yet. I have the pre results, but I don't have the post results yet because we haven't been able to impact their situations. But it's important that you know and hear the story of these two male patients, because at some point in time, and I'm not wishing this for you, but at some point in time, cancer touches each and every one of our homes in this country, whether it's within our home or it's a loved one or a neighbor. So cancer is a insidious condition that is now affecting more than 2 out of every 3 women and 1 out of every 3 men, if you look at the most current statistics. And so knowing and understanding, and of course this week, if you're a ESPN college basketball fan, you see Coach Jimmy Valvano giving his epic speech when cancer was riddling his body with tumors. And he really did some amazing things in terms of getting awareness out there. He did that really well. And I was actually watching the speech with my wife this week, and I asked her, do you think he knew when he was giving this speech that it was going to be as powerful as it is? And we both kind of looked at each other, and after a short discussion, we said, well, I don't think there was any way he could have known. But during this week, every year in the college basketball season, they must replay his speech 50 times in this week, because it is so powerful. And it's so powerful because he didn't win the battle. But even as he was facing and staring death right in the eye, he was still imparting wisdom and impacting future generations by the way he lived, by the way he conducted himself, and by hopefully the movement that he spurred on to get tested. Now, I'm not talking about all the money that's been devoted to finding a cure. That's a whole different topic for another day. But if I take something good out of his speech, and I take a lot of good things about out of his speech, because he talks about a lot of things that are really closely related in my mind to what each day should look like for a person on earth. As Coach Jimmy V says, we should be moved to tears each day. We should laugh, and we should enjoy time with those that we love. And so that's kind of an amazing thing, because for someone who's, again, like I just said, staring death right in the eyeballs, the meaning of life is all coming to the forefront. It's all rushing to the front of his mind. And he had his wife and his daughters and even his mother all sitting in the first row when he walked up to the stage to give the speech. And he couldn't even move up the 5 or 6 stairs that they had on this stage without help from a couple of other coaches and friends. And so I talk about that because I spent much of my afternoon yesterday watching some videos online about various natural health care professionals like me. They have different credentials than mine, but a similar vein of how they practice in the functional medicine or functional nutrition space. And I watched one girl from Canada give an amazing talk about how she helped her sister's father-in-law with his stomach cancer diagnosis. Now, she was a naturopathic doctor, and if you look up the laws and how naturopathic doctors and functional medicine and functional nutrition providers are different, they're not all that different. Naturopathic doctors have scope of practice in about 13 different states in this country, to my last knowledge. And of course, DCs are licensed in all 50 states. But if you're working with a DC that just really does musculoskeletal care, that's great. And there are a number of brilliant DCs in this area and beyond in this country that do awesome work with musculoskeletal care. But if you're looking for something a little bit deeper, a little bit more impactful in terms of a cancer diagnosis that you may be dealing with, then you have to look for somebody like me, like Dr. Merkel, who are board certified in clinical nutrition or have that functional medicine or functional nutrition training. These are all different buzzwords that people use online, and some of them are, I guess, kind of misused in a way. But you can read all about my credentials on our website at take2healthcare.com. I've been in practice for 20 years, all of it at Take 2 Healthcare, right here in Dayton, Ohio. We're on State Route 48 in between Whip and Ron Roads, same side of the road as Dorothy Lane Market, about a half a mile down the road from there. So if that's where you're looking for us, that's where you'll find us. You can call our clinic at 937-433-3241, or you can find us on the web at take2, and then healthcare.com. But I wanted to tell you a little bit. I know there was an article about longevity. We'll do that. But prostate cancer case. Walked into my office 2 weeks ago on a Wednesday late. He didn't walk in. He had an appointment already set. But he came in with a walker. And I've known this guy for about 5 or 6 years. And he first got tested in 2019 and then again in 2020. And then during the COVID pandemic, we didn't really see much of him. And he came back in a couple weeks ago and he said, "Doc, I've just been told I have prostate cancer and it's already spread to my bones." And I said, "Wow, that's really harsh news. When did you find this out?" And he said, "Well, we figured it out about 2 or 3 weeks ago. I was having a lot of back pain, woke up, couldn't move, really, really high amounts of pain, transported by squad to the emergency room. They started doing some imaging on him and found that he has cancer from his prostate that has already spread to his bone." Now, this case will involve some co-management, so I won't be his only provider on this one, and that's okay. That's what he needs right now. But I'll be co-managing this case for him. He has a current PSA level in his blood of 151. And for those of you that don't speak laboratory diagnosis, really should be less than 4. If you're a healthy male having a healthy prostate function or having healthy prostate function, then the value should be no higher than 4. And he's at 151. Now, this isn't actually the highest PSA I've ever seen on a patient. I had another patient who was 351. So there's a wide-ranging variety of PSA scores. And what does PSA really tell us? Well, it doesn't tell us anything much in terms of specificity in identifying cancer only, because PSA marker will shoot to the moon in a variety of conditions related to prostate. So benign prostatic hypertrophy, prostatic hyperplasia, even prostatitis, which is an infection in the prostate, those can all elevate PSA, but almost nothing pushes the PSA above 100 or 150 unless it's cancer. Now, he's got 2 pathological fractures in his lumbar spine and in his sacrum. So when I did his consult with he and his wife, he was actually standing during the whole consult because he was more comfortable standing than sitting. Yeah, I'd say if you have a broken lumbar spine vertebrae and fractures throughout your sacrum, which is up above your tailbone but below your belt line, it's not going to feel real good when you sit down or lay down. So standing was his most comfortable position. We did our entire 35-minute talk with him standing, and that was fine because I needed to get some really crucial information from him so I could figure out how we're going to help him. And he came to me again on high-dose pain medication just so he could get rest over the first few weeks since his diagnosis. He comes in, he's agitated, he's worried, he's angry. And he and his new wife had just, his fiance recently had gotten married within the last few months, so it's his wife now. And he's highly motivated to live longer and help his wife and be an active participant in their new marriage. He wants to have a functioning body to enjoy his life going forward. He's in his very late 50s, if not early 60s. I think he might be 61 or 62. I don't have his age in front of me. And when I spoke to him again this week to go through some of his results with him, he's already completed first round of chemotherapy. He's got 5 more rounds to go. They'll be treating and then giving him 3 weeks off, then treating, giving him 3 weeks off until he finishes 6 rounds. I asked him about lumbar spine surgery and sacral surgery, and he said, "No, the doctors think that if we can get my PSA down and get some of the cancer markers under control, that I won't need spinal surgery. The bones will heal and repair themselves." I said, "Okay, great. That's fantastic news. he'll be much better off in the long run if he doesn't have to have spinal surgery. So now that I knew that, and I have a set of tests on him, and with all that information that I was able to see and gather from our thorough blood panel, I checked about 65 different blood markers on him in one blood test. And the reason I did that was I needed to have some very specific information so that I could figure out how to help him in the best way possible. And this is what we do on our patients, whether they have a cancer diagnosis or not. But we need to test thoroughly, appropriately, and properly initially so that we can have a very good understanding of where his body is at the beginning of this battle that he's about to face and he's undergoing currently. And so with all the information in front of me, I knew that my treatment options for him were going to be focused around supporting him with diet, nutritional supplements to help him sleep well. Why? Because if you're sleeping better, you can actually heal and repair at night while your body's at rest. That's when it gets to fix itself and heal and repair from some of that damage that's ongoing. He can then heal and repair faster. We're going to be targeting new bone growth with some of his supplementation. Certainly calcium, magnesium, vitamin D3 have all been shown in laboratory studies to improve bone mineral density. And is that the way that we're helping him with these fractured vertebrae? Well, no, not specifically, but it can't hurt. It can't hurt. He's already got pathological fractures in his lumbar and sacral spine. He needs all the support and help there that he can get. And we're going to be helping keep his immune system level and balanced so that he can endure some of his standard treatment. The interesting blood findings for him, and I always find these incredibly interesting. Hopefully the listeners out there will find them interesting too, but you've probably heard me mention several of these on this program before, but the first that we came to for him, that was a code blue emergency value. So alkaline phosphatase is a blood lab marker that tells us if we have liver and bone involvement, like this patient does, already knowing that he has fractures in his lumbar and sacral spine, I expected that the alkaline phosphatase would be a little bit high. Well, for healthy range patients, 106 or less is the goal, 135 or less to fit the clinical range. His value was over 1,100. It was 1,119.0. That was his current value. And so that tells me we've got some really extensive involvement within the liver and the bone. How do we know it's in the liver? Well, we checked a couple of other key values too. The LDH is not cholesterol, that's LDL, but LDH is lactate dehydrogenase. That's a marker for cellular destruction. He's way high on that one too, code blue. And then he has an SGPT value of 145, and that's a liver marker. So that's how we really know it's coming from the liver as well. And it's not necessarily that the liver has a tumor within it, but the liver is working very, very hard to keep the rest of the blood as clean as possible so that functions can remain as normal as possible. So we've got a lot of work to do to help this fella out, but we're going to do it. I have all the optimism and confidence that we can, and he's got me as part of his team. Again, I'm not the only one because this is a cancer case, and he needs me plus a bunch of other help to get through this. So we will take a quick break right now. You've been listening to Dr. Andrew Dyer this morning, and we'll be back right after this live in studio on WHIO. When Van Halen brings you back in, you know it's going to be good. So here we are. And we're back on the other side of the first break. Just want to finish the case I was talking about with prostate cancer. And the other key blue marker that I didn't get to discuss before the break was the ferritin score. And so you guys, if you're frequent listeners to our program, you've certainly heard us talk about ferritin before. And ferritin is the backup supply for iron in the blood. And the reason it's super significant in this particular case is when ferritin is elevated off the charts, like this patient's was, his number was 1,072, so 1,072, should have been 200 or less to fit healthy, 400 or less to fit the clinical range. So he's 600-700 points higher than he should be. And the reason he's that high is because his body is dealing with a ton of inflammation around these tumors. I'm not talking about the inflammation being right around the tumor, although that's quite possible too. But when there's tumors in the body, the whole system gets inflamed or shows that presentation within the laboratory assessment. So these are some of the key findings that when we're looking at regular standard patients that don't know they have cancer, when we look thoroughly at these collection of markers, so the alkaline phosphatase could give us a clue, the LDH could give us a clue, the liver and pancreatic enzymes, the ferritin, the C-reactive protein, the ESR, before we even get to look at the white and red blood cells, all those different markers have got to clue the astute physician into thinking cancer, 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 until we can prove that it's not. And sometimes that's a tough task too. And that actually leads me into the next case I want to talk about. And we're going to hit these two cancer cases, then we'll go on to our other topics that I already mentioned. But this gentleman, another gentleman, different fella, he came into my office this week to go through his test results. Now, he's 67 years old. He's 6 feet tall. He weighs 194 pounds. He's pretty much my body frame, my body build, but I'm not 67. I'm 47. So he's got 20 years on me. Pretty much a healthy guy. I say pretty much because he had a really weird thing happen to him. He retired from his position at the base. And when he went back in to renew the prescriptions he had been put on, his provider had been shipped off to a new station point. And he went in and spoke with just the pharmacist behind the desk to say, okay, I had these prescriptions. I've run out. I don't know if anyone's renewed them for me since my provider retired. And the pharmacist, I believe it was the pharmacist, was behind the desk at the front of the office and told the patient that if he didn't feel bad being off of his lisinopril and Crestor, then he no longer needed them. I thought that was the most bizarre thing I've heard in 20 years because that's not normally the way they do it. But after that, the patient decided he needed to take his healthcare needs elsewhere. And that's how he landed in my office. And so coming in to see me, he was wanting to check things a little deeper and more thoroughly anyway. And this gave him the motivation to do that. And so when he and I sat down and talked and did our first intake, that was back in late October. And it just took him a little while to get things collected, blood tests, hair tests. So I finally just got to sit down with him. And that's not the typical. We can usually turn things around in about 2 weeks. But there were various hurdles that he had to jump through to get all this done. And when he did, and we sat down this week, we noticed one critical finding standing out above the rest. And in his case, it is a marker called CA19-9. CA standing for cancer antigen. So when we test these values in the blood, we expect them to come back normal if we don't know the patient has a problem. But when they don't, that's big time alarm bells going off. And in the case of this fella, he's at 489 on the CA19-9 marker, should be 21 or less. And so we don't know. That's not enough information actually to make the diagnosis of cancer. So I had to refer him on or suggest for him to do some other testing. We are going to take a break, and then as soon as we come back from that, I'm going to pick up right where we're leaving off. Thanks for tuning in this morning. Hopefully you're listening as you're cruising around in the Miami Valley to Dr. Andrew Dyer on WHIO. Hey, back we go at it again. This is Dr. Andrew Dyer joining you again live this morning. And we were talking about a cancer marker named CA19-9. And for this particular gentleman, it was very high. Now, let me just paint the picture for you again a little bit on this fella. He's 6 feet tall, weighs 194 pounds. He's an avid nature photographer. He likes to get out and walk and do all the things that he enjoys with his wife and with his family. And so he had really no inkling that he was sick. And we're still not entirely sure, because the thing about CA19-9 is while it certainly is a useful tool for the detection of pancreatic or GI cancers, it can also be elevated in other cancers too, like colorectal, lung, even gallbladder. But there are other conditions that are not cancerous that can also elevate the CA19-9. And those include gallstones, cystic fibrosis, which we know he doesn't have, rheumatoid arthritis. He didn't exhibit any other signs of that. Liver disease and even pancreatitis. So when I saw his number and I sat down and spoke with him, I think that was on Thursday morning that we spoke, I suggested that he consider a couple of other tests, and he's going to work on getting those done. I had to give him the referral to another clinic, but he needs to get some other testing done to for sure highlight what this elevated CA19-9 may be coming from a diagnostic perspective. Now, maybe they can figure that out, maybe they can't, but in the next month, I gave him some very specific instructions to follow on what to eat and what not to eat and vitamins and minerals to take from a supplemental standpoint so that even while he's awaiting some of these other tests, we can be attempting to help him get better. And so with that approach, my thought is that when we get to come back and see this number in the next 4 to 6 weeks, my goal is that we can reduce it by 50%. A 50% reduction on that number would still put him way too high from the healthy range, but it would be marked improvement from where he started. And so hopefully within the next 6 or 8 weeks, when you hear me sometime late January, early February, I'll be able to give you an update on both of these cases, the prostate cancer case and the potential pancreatic cancer case. I wanted to say a quick interesting thing, and this is said with the greatest amount of humility that I can share it with, but Take-Two Healthcare has long been the choice for other doctors that get sick to become patients of ours. And while they're not necessarily the ones that we're looking for and wanting to take care of, we will take care of them. The challenge with other doctors, and I put myself in this category a little bit, is that other doctors come in looking for care, especially when cancer diagnoses strike, but other doctors make difficult patients because they already have a high level of training and they quote unquote know everything. They aren't always willing to listen to the advice and make real changes to their diet and lifestyle. I've had several over the years that have come seeking advice, and some of them have done real well, and others have just thought, well, if I didn't really need Dr. Dyer's advice because I already know all this stuff. Okay, fine. No problem. I wish them the best, but ultimately it comes back to if other doctors, other colleagues in our professional circle are entrusting us with their care, don't you think we could do a pretty good job for your family as well? Just think about that for a minute. Another topic, importance of food sensitivity testing in the hard-to-solve cases. Sat down with a patient yesterday, and she had already been on our program for a couple of months. She'd been on it for about 3 months, and she was doing really well. Her husband went through the testing and protocol first, and he had done really well. So then the wife came back with the husband about 6 months later and said, well, I want to get tested too. I want to get as healthy as he is now. And she's a little bit younger, but she was having some health struggles as well. And so the first 2 months on the program, she breezed through. She did great. She didn't have any issues, no stomach problems, no headaches, no allergies to anything that we were providing for her. And then as we started in on the next phase of things and modified her vitamin and mineral nutrient list based on her progress within her lab testing, she began to struggle some more with typical signs of food allergy or food sensitivity. She was getting a burning tongue sensation a lot of the time right after taking her vitamins and right after eating her first meal too, because those were going together at the same time. She was getting a lot of stomach pain, some nausea. She had the hallmark of what we call allergic shiners. It's like the little dark black circles that form under your eye and the skin. Like they make a little puffy, pillowy presentation under the skin, but it's dark and black in color, even if you're a fair-skinned individual, which she was. And she reported to me yesterday that these little allergic shiners on her face have been present for as far back as she can remember, and she's 70 years old right now. She was actually very, very happy when she sat down with me because I had ordered for her a food sensitivity test. And we looked at 250 foods, and we also looked at a collection of about 40 to 50 additives that are common in supplements. So it wasn't that she was really allergic to taking things like vitamin A or vitamin C or vitamin E, but in some of the products that she was using, there were other additives, fillers. I'll give you the best example for her, malic acid came back as a high-level sensitivity for her. Well, malic acid is the most common form of magnesium that we're using in our office. But she didn't have any problems the first couple months, and now we had a test that said, okay, she needs to take it out of her diet for about 3 months. then she should be well enough to put some of it back in on a slow basis. And we don't have to use a magnesium with malic acid. That's just the most common one we use, because for about 99% of people, it works great. It's easily absorbed, doesn't hurt the stomach, creates no real issues. But once we had her sensitivity testing in front of us, we had to make a few amendments to her list. And she went down the list with me, and I had already suggested for her to start at the top of her nutrient list and just take one thing at a time for a couple days. And then after 3 or 4 days, add the second thing. 3 or 4 more days later, add the third thing to the first two. And she's about halfway, maybe 2/3 of the way down her list. And she wanted to know, well, now that I know all this information, should I start that process over? And I said, no, but the ones you know that you're reacting to still, we're going to keep out of the picture. So we deleted a few from her list based on her self-reported sensitivities and allergies to those things. But we were able to keep her on most of the good nutrient support that she needed to help impact her test results on the other internal health tests that we had run through her blood work, through her hair testing for toxicities. And she's going to, again, be able to make progress. She said the funniest and neatest thing that I've ever had a patient tell me. She looked me square in the eye and she said, I'm going to nominate you for sainthood. And my response to her was, well, my wife's going to get there way quicker than I am. But that was very kind and very nice of her to say. But I didn't do anything that shouldn't have been done or was, it was long appropriate to do all the right things. And so I didn't do anything different or better than most would have done. But in taking a look at it from a clinical nutrition perspective rather than a medical diagnostic perspective, we're able to give her some real strategies that she can utilize so that her symptoms can ultimately get better. And if any of the things that we were giving her in the first place were creating or causing a reaction, well, then we need to take those out for a little while. Now, we'll come back to this food sensitivity test on her in about 1 year, because the body does change in its immune responses over the course of that year. She actually came back with no sensitivity to any of the 3 proteins in cow's milk, which I thought was highly unusual because those are common offending agents. But casein, lactose, and whey protein, she tested negative for no response to any of those. She had a moderate response to the gluten and gliadin proteins that are found in wheat. And so a couple of those big major key areas, she's already dove in right away to the suggested what to eat and what not to eat. And actually through this testing lab, they put together a rotational menu plan for her based on her findings that tells her, okay, on day one, you can eat all these different fruits, vegetables, and proteins. And then on day two, you got to eat these, and day three. So it's complicated and it's complex, but when you've been dealing with symptoms and problems for 60 years, you think she was pretty willing to make a change for a couple of months? Yeah, you better believe it. She sure was. So that was awesome. It was great to be able to help her out that way. And I really appreciate her and her husband coming in and saying kind things too at the end of that, because it could have been a really frustrating experience for both of us, but she made it great. And we were just able to give her new information that she's now able to utilize to be healthier and get healthier. And I know I promised you an article from Harvard, and that's where we are now. So we're back to our starting point. I was looking at a few different articles this week, but this one I thought was particularly interesting because the headline was Harvard's New Health Bombshell. It's not sleep loss or no exercise. It's these 15 daily habits that are silently destroying you. I thought, well, that's not very cheery, but I thought I really needed to read that in order to keep my patients informed and keep myself informed. I was actually able to make a few changes from what I read in this article this week that I think were very, very helpful. So I'm not going to bore you with the intro yet, but here it is. Number one of the 15, starting your day with your phone. So the neuroscientists at Harvard say that quote-unquote instant cortisol spike caused by morning scrolling primes the body for the next 12 hours to be stress-filled. You think you're catching up on emails you've missed overnight or text messages you've missed overnight, but your brain actually thinks you're in danger. When you start your day by scrolling through your phone, in the estimation of these Harvard neuroscientists, it is not the right way to get started. Number two, sitting more than 6 hours a day. Not dramatic, but deadly. Harvard's long-term study found that prolonged sitting increases mortality risk more than smoking for certain adults. And we know that smoking is one of the leading causes of premature death on the planet. And now sitting is taking the lead on that. Eating in a hurry is number three. So when you sit down and you have a 25-minute lunch break and you just shovel it in so fast you hardly take a breath in between, you really should count to 30. When you have a mouthful of food, you should count to 30 and have 30 seconds of chewing in that bite of food before you begin to swallow it. Why? Because the saliva in our mouths starts the process of digestion. So unless we move and chomp that food and really get it churned up in there, the gut is going to have to try to break down whole foods. If you've ever seen an animal at the zoo or at an aquatic center eat like a seal or a whale, they swallow those fish whole. But they have a completely different digestive process than we do. We're designed to chew things, not just inhale them into our gut. Drinking coffee before water. This was something I used to be a little bit guilty of, and I know I tell my patients to limit coffee intake, and I never really did more than one coffee a day, and I usually just did a double shot of espresso, and that was it, which actually has far less caffeine in it than a typical tall coffee does. But this week, I got off all coffee. I was having some digestive problems, and I decided I'm going to start with that, just get the coffee out of the way. And so this week on the ride to work, I just took a big thermos of water. And I drank it before I got there. I always drink tons of water at work. We have an RO system in our office. So I drink probably 3 to 4 quarts a day anyway. But I'm starting my day with water instead of coffee. And it has made a load of difference. Now, does it take me a little bit longer to get perked up? Maybe, but maybe not. And actually, the neuroscientists from Harvard say, Harvard's hydration research warns waking up dehydrated plus adding caffeine equals compounded fatigue, headaches, and cortisol dysregulation. Well, what is cortisol? Cortisol is one of the stress hormones released by the adrenal glands, the tiny little triangular-shaped glands that sit on top of each person's kidneys. They are responsible for that cortisol production. When you're in hypercortisol, it's called hypercortisolemia, but hypercortisol production, that means your body's going to store more body fat. It's going to be heavier than it should be when your adrenals are working overtime. So you think coffee wakes you up, it actually worsens the crash. So next time you wake up and go for starting the coffee maker, maybe you need to drink some water at least first before you get going on the coffee. Number five is working through lunch. Harvard behavioral studies show that this leads to mental depletion, emotional numbness, and decreased productivity. So skipping the rest equals accelerating the burnout. So working through lunch, not a good idea. If you can skip that, please try to do that. Number six, ignoring micro stressors. Not big stress, we're talking micro stress. So tiny little frictions like clutter, unread emails, notifications, having a messy desk. These were workplace, obviously workplace focused, but Harvard calls these the quote unquote invisible stress loads linked to burnout and early biological aging. So anything we can do to reduce that load would be good for our long-term health and longevity, both on the mental and physical side of things. Constant low-level noise exposure. The hum of traffic, a crowded cafe, chatter in the office. I know I was trying to knock out a bunch of continuing ed hours this week in between patients, writing reports. We had our vitamin sale going on. And then when some of the staff would come back and load up vitamin lists and chat with each other, which is totally fine, it was just distracting because I had my headphones on, I was working, I was waiting to get buzzed to go to see my next patient. So it just makes it for a harder day. And I could actually feel that in my body. When I got in the car to drive home at the end of the night, I could feel that, just that angst in the middle of my chest. Not going outside before noon. This is number 8 on our list of 15. Not going outside before noon. Daylight exposure early in the day calibrates your circadian rhythms. So it helps to wake you up. We should sleep when the sun is down, and we should be awake when the sun is up. That's pretty typical, right? Grace is giving me that single. That means we've got to take a little break. So you've been listening to Dr. Andrew Dyer. We have about 6 left on our list, and we'll cover them on the other side of the break. You've been listening to us on WHIO. And we are back and rolling. Thank you very much. It is that Ask the Experts time, and I was honored and privileged to be your expert for the hour today. We have just a few more minutes to wrap up. So finishing our list from Harvard, short, shallow breathing is number 9. When we're under stress, our body has a natural tendency to breathe that way anyway. So we really need to focus on getting good, deep breaths into the lungs and then blowing all that air out of the lungs just to help keep things moving. Eating healthy, quote unquote, but mindless snacks. So even clean snacks spike insulin when eaten unconsciously. The metabolic lab at Harvard calls it, quote unquote, the silent weight gainer. It's not junk food, it's the frequency. So checking your phone while walking. This too can be something that you think might be harmless, but Harvard's cognitive research shows it makes your brain operate in a fragmented mode, increasing anxiety and reducing memory retention. Number 12 on our list of 15, delaying hard tasks. Not procrastination, but micro delays. Postponing small tasks raises stress markers and creates chronic mental load. Harvard calls it compounded cognitive drag. 13, not drinking water, enough water, until you're thirsty. When you're thirsty, the body's already giving you the too late, we're dehydrated signal. So you got to drink before you're thirsty. Harvard's hydration studies link this habit to fatigue, overeating, headaches, and even mood instability. Carrying emotional tension in your body is number 14. In the jaw, shoulders, back, even with, again, that shallow breathing. The psychologists at Harvard found that chronic tension predicts long-term anxiety and depression more than life events. And then finally on the list of 15 things we talked about at the very start of your day, picking up your phone, and now we're at the end of the day and ending your day with digital stimulation. Netflix, TikTok, Instagram loops. Harvard Sleep Labs found that blue light plus emotional stimulation reduces deep sleep by up to 60%. It isn't entertainment, it's slow self-erasure. So, devastating conclusion, worst habits don't feel like habits. Your brain doesn't warn you. Your body doesn't scream. The damage is slow, invisible, but cumulative. But it is indeed damage. The core finding in this study is terrifying but empowering. Here's the last good quote of the day. Humans are not destroyed by disasters. They are destroyed by routines. So what can you do with that information? How can you put that into practice? And if you're being destroyed by your routine, that means your routine is wrong. Your routine is off. It doesn't include all the things it should to help you meet your goal. And if your goal coming up as we wind down in 2025 and get ready to skyrocket into 2026, if your goal is to be a healthier version of you in 2026, perhaps you need to bring in an expert in that area to help you along. I mean, we count on other professionals in other key areas of our life. We have accountants to help us with our number crunching. We have doctors, we have coaches, we have personal trainers. Why not get an expert in health to go to battle for you no matter what you're facing from a diagnosis standpoint? You don't need to have cancer right now in order to get benefit from the work we do in our office. I know we talk about those kind of cases a lot on this program because they're fun and they're exciting and they're wonderful when we help, but there's a lot of work we do that are on far more simple health issues than cancer. So if you've got high blood pressure, high cholesterol, diabetes, we'd love to be able to help you. So give us a call, 937-433-3241, or find us on the web at take2healthcare.com. You've been listening live this morning to Dr. Andrew Dyer on AM 1290 and News 95.7 WHIO.